All right, welcome back to Solid Ground. Today is the first of a class that'll be probably at least three or four in length. I imagine maybe a little bit longer because the topic is one, so central to the core belief system of Christianity, and two, I think in many ways one of the most, if not controversial, at least difficult to understand. And to such a degree that I'll make an extreme statement here, I've never heard an analogy for the Trinity that was right. So I'll try to prove this as we go along, so bring up your favorites at any point that you want. But it seems to me that we in Christianity do a very poor job sometimes of understanding it, and certainly a poor job of teaching it, because I think that a lot of the bad concept that happens out there in lay Christianity comes from a lack of the people who are supposed to be knowing it and teaching it properly, or understanding it themselves, or alternately teaching it in a way that's correct. So it's also the case that if you the kind of core orthodox small o Christianity that says the Trinity is the concept of God. So we're talking about concepts of God that were laid out in the first of the major councils of Christendom kind of coming together, that basically said, hey, we've got a bunch of different concepts of God out there. We're going to lay down kind of the law, so to speak, or we're at least going to get together and say, this is the way that it is, so that everybody understands it. Those councils kind of form the core of what Christian orthodoxy is and are frequently referenced today. And even in some of the more liturgical types of Christianity are read frequently as affirmations of faith, of doctrinal core to Christianity. So all that to say, if the Trinity is not true, if the Trinity is not the right concept of God, then Christianity is not true. Or maybe you could say Christianity would need a major modification, probably back in the direction of Judaism's concept, in order to be true. So I would say this is a very important, distinct doctrine. And of the three major world religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, that have at the core the same generally theistic God that all of the arguments that we had previously been talking about refer to. So all these arguments prove some sort of theistic or deistic God, a personal creator type of God who's all-powerful and all fill in the blank with all the alls that are there. That really only fits these three religions. Maybe you could argue Zoroastrianism back in the day or something like that. Some concepts of Hinduism might contain something sort of like that. But those three are really the ones that have that at core. The key differentiator between those three, at least in terms of Christianity, is the concept of the Trinity and who Jesus was particularly. So this is maybe, if it's not the most important concept in all of Christianity, it's the most important distinguishing concept in Christianity. And so it behooves us to know as much about it as we reasonably can. And then also we ought to know what its application is for our daily lives. So lest you think this will be dry, philosophical, theological talk only, I think you'll find that there are some things about the Trinity that will have key implications for what we do in our daily lives, both as Christians and just human beings.
How we feel that God sees us.
I think that is a key part of it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely right. Okay, so let's talk. We'll talk a little bit of abstraction first, and then we'll go into the scriptures to look at it. So we'll start with what almost every time I hear the Trinity talked about or taught, a teacher gets up and says, "Let me tell you the things that this is not. It's not this concept. It's not that concept. It's not this." Great. Tell me what it is first, and then you can tell me where my thoughts go wrong on it. So what it is relatively easy to state. It's not easy to write if you try to write with the eraser on. One, and I'm going to use this word right here so I don't confuse anybody, because if you use another word for that, it immediately becomes confusing. One being, three persons. So that's in four words, two on either side, that's what the concept of the Trinity is. It's one being in three persons, or you can say it's a tri-personal being. So from some of the arguments that we had, we know that God is personal. We can say it this way: God is personal. What we mean by that is God is not just a force that's out there, or not a static state that's out there. God is not, you know, kind of the Spinozan God that is the universe type of thing, or God is not some Platonic ideal. God is a being that can think and act, that has agency. Now, God is personal, but is not a person. Now, why is that? Why would the statement God is personal or God is a person be false if God is a Trinity? What's the right way to say this? What's the right way to turn this? If you said this, God is a person.
The Son of God is the person of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So how do you make this? How do you make this statement true? If I'm telling you this statement is false according to Trinitarianism, how would you alter that statement to make it true? You could, but then I think we get back out of, right. thank you, Aristotle. Straight. If you said God is not a person, though, it might walk back. So let me say that you can modify one word in this and make it true. And the word would be this. We instead say God is three persons. So that's how you make this statement true. And if you can understand the difference between that, you actually understand the concept of the Trinity at its most fundamental level. So the look on your face is the look on most people's faces, which is this. When you talk about us, human beings, how many people are we? If I say, hey, my name is Scott, and someone might ask me, are you a person or are you a robot? Like, maybe that's a question you could ask somebody. More and more today, that's closer to being a reasonable question. And I say, no, I'm not a robot. I'm a person. And what I mean by that is probably, really, I have free will. Or I can think for myself. I'm not just a programmed machine. So we won't get into what all that means, but whatever your concept is of a person, just know that the being of God, if someone said to you, walked up and said to you, I am God, and you said to him, oh, are you a kind of a robot or a person? The Trinitarian God's proper response is, I am three persons. That would be, if you tried to say, if you ask God, who are you, or what constitutes you? He would say, I am one God, but three persons. Now, that's the statement of what Trinitarianism, the question that I've really never heard answered, and I'm sure it's out there, but I never heard answered personally that somebody gave it to me, was it's not the what. The what's right there. It's the how. How is that possible? How is it possible that somebody be one being but three persons? So alternately, if a human being walks up to you and says, hi, my name is Scott and Andrew and Bob, and what would your follow-on question be? Well, it's wonderful to see you. From which institution have you recently been prematurely released? So if you say, Peter says, why did God tell Moses he's I am instead of we are? All right, Peter, of course, jumping ahead as always. Peter, you're going to have to answer that or ask that one again in a little bit. So hold on to that one, but that's a good way to get into it when we get to the scriptural part. But God is three persons is the idea. And so if a human being says to you, I am three persons, you might say to yourself, how can you be one human being but three persons? Now I will get to that eventually, because we're going to go through a lot of now what it is not. So I've told you what it is, and if you're wondering, okay, minorly helpful, I'm not sure that I get that. I want to at least exhaust for you the other ways we've thought about it until I tell you my way of conceiving of it, because my way of conceiving of it may or may not be right. So I've taken my way of conceiving of it to some of the lead Christian philosophers. I've actually, amazingly, if I've accomplished anything in my life, it's the following. I've had a lead Christian philosopher say, this is a good argument and understanding of the Trinity, and I've had a Protestant and a lead Catholic, not a lead, a Catholic theologian and philosopher say, this is good also, I agree with this. So I've got the Catholic and the Protestant sides at least saying, this concept is not heretical, which that alone, I almost want to drop the mic and walk away and say, all right, I'm done here. Yes, sir?
Is this like the three faces of me. God is like has multiple personalities. Is that what? No, I'm not joking.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's a completely legitimate question. Yeah, I get you. So let's roll through what it is not now. So I've told you what it is that God is personal, but he is not a person. Or really what we ought to say is not one person. And so we say God is three persons. So if you said in the term of like Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you might ask the question, well, is the Son God? And the Christian would reply, yes. And you say, okay, so that's it. He'd be like, no, that's not all of God. And you say, what do you mean not all of God? Do you mean not all of the gods, like Greek style, Zeus, Pluto, Neptune type of thing? No, those are three different beings. God is one being and three persons. Now, I think the easiest thing for us to think, you know, the three, I'm not terribly familiar with the concept, but of somebody who believes they're three people but is psychologically damaged, that's not the idea we want to give to God. God is not a schizophrenic with multiple personality disorder. That's not it. It's also not the case that God is three gods who just have this really tight relationship, right? There's a Father, there's a Son, and there's a Spirit, and they've been kind of in this eternal hug forever, and then, you know, they as they kind of huddle, you know, the Father says to the Son, all right, I want you to go out and make the world. Spirit, I want you to do this. Okay, ready, break. That's not the concept either, because that's tritheism. That's three gods. So I'm happy because everybody's looking confused, which means that this explanation will be a benefit in the long run. Okay, so it is not the case that God is three gods. It's not the case that he's one God who has some sort of split personality disorder. The idea here is the being that is God, and this is going to be the thesis you'll hear running throughout all this thing, not only is three persons, but given the world that he was going to create, that he did create, this world that we see here, he has to be three persons. It's logically impossible for him not to be three persons. That's what I'm going to establish for you by the end, I hope, but ultimately it's the what is right here. The how is probably the part that is difficult.
One of the things that was so amazing to me when I'm learning some of this stuff was that, in my mind, I thought, like, it's actually sort of illogical or improbable that God would be three persons anyway. And you see a lot of the Old Testament, like, God is one or God is one, you know. And so you read through this, and to me, like, always growing up thinking, like, I was kind of like, yeah, it's a little weird, but I'm going with the rest of it. It's fine, you know. And when you get into this logical improbability of the creation of the universe the way it is, it's kind of astounding. It's almost like it's the opposite of what I thought.
Right. That's yes. Cool. Yes. I think that when you realize those kinds of things, that obviously you've been thinking about it for a while, but that's a good thing to realize. Yes, sir.
I'd like to mention the best, in my opinion, the best explanation I've heard was Daniel P. Fuller's The Unity of the Bible, his book. He has an explanation that I thought...
That you were pleased with. We'll post it up to the Solid Ground website, which when we're up running next time, we'll pull it up again. But there are two now. There's Scott Solid Ground, and then there's the Solid Ground kind of, what's the term for the type of site it is? Yeah, okay.
So, Facebook, instead of following Scott's personal page, you'll want to follow Scott's Solid Ground page, or our
Solid Ground page, right. We're trying to move everything over to that. Hopefully you've seen friend requests and all that coming from there, but that's where to post stuff up to. So I'll post whatever Amazon link or whatever you want to that one up on that. Okay, yeah. Or tell me afterwards and I'll do it from here.
Okay.
So let's. There's more that could be said on this, but I want to jump right into the scripture initially to at least justify why are we bothering to do this? Because you're going to have to do some of the looking up on your own here, because we can't post it up because I'm not lashed up to the internet quite yet. If you think of Islam, or Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, there are two core statements. Let's take the core statements of it. Everybody knows if there is a core statement to Islam, what is it? Anybody know what, like, it's the first pillar of Islam? Like, you, in order to, some Muslims say that if you say the first thing, you're a Muslim, period. Some people say you have to do all five.
God is great.
Yep, God is great, but it's something that they break out that's actually, I think, very much typed on on the, that's often the sign off right before the more violent end of the spectrum do something violent. But it'll, in Arabic, it's La ilaha illallahu Muhammad Rasulullah, which is there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. So that is like bare minimum Islam. There is no God but God, and Allah is his prophet. Muhammad is his prophet. Muhammad was coming out of an age of paganism in the whole region, but in his hometown in particular, where the Kaaba, which is the big black square that you see all Muslims pray towards, no matter where they are, they're supposed to establish kind of the direction there, and they pray in that direction. That big stone cube is built over a earlier holy site that was, according to Islam, built by Abraham himself, and that is the same God that is the God of Abraham. And so you have the word in Arabic, Allah, Al is the, and Lah is God, so the God. This is actually exactly the same as how the Jewish translation of the old of the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, uses in Greek, Ha Theos, which is the God. So Allah and Ha Theos in Arabic and Greek both say the God. So it sounds strange to our English ears to hear someone say, I worship the God. But the purpose in putting the in front of it in both instances is to say not one of the gods. By the, it's an exclusionary statement that says there is not a panoply of gods of which the one that I'm worshiping is one. This statement says there is only one God, and all these idols are figments of your imagination. They're not real gods over whom God that we worship is some sort of reigning sovereign. Yes, sir?
What does Yahweh mean?
Yahweh is, as Peter moved to it, would actually be the name of God. In this case, Yahweh is a contraction of four Hebrew letters, and ancient Hebrew doesn't have vowels in it, so we think that that's the way that's pronounced. Everybody thinks that's the way it's pronounced, but that is just Hebrew for I am. When Moses asks God, who shall I say sent them? Now remember, what Moses is coming out of Egypt. And Egypt, you got as many gods, basically, as you got people. And, you know, is this the guy with the jackal's head? Is this the guy with the eagle's head? Is this, you know, who is this, Osiris? Who is this? That's, who shall I tell the Hebrews, who have basically forgotten God a little bit, who shall I say has sent them? And he says, tell them, I am that I am. Tell them, I am has sent them. And that statement, that statement contains a ton of stuff that we will dive into very deeply here, eventually, not today, but basically, God is telling you a whole slew of things when he says what his name is. And we'll get to some of the things he's telling you. Okay. In the same way that if that's the statement of what it is minimally to be a Muslim, what is the statement? What is the Jewish statement of God of what God kind of is? What is the core Jewish statement of faith? If there is a single statement, what is it? Yes, sir.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one.
Yes, and this is called the Shema in Hebrew, and it is the thing that you say. It is the declaration of faith. So some people who will point to Islam and say it's derivative of the Jewish faith and the Christian faith, if you're going to take that as true, one of the derivative points is very clearly Muhammad sees the Shema and he makes an equivalent one. He sees a statement about God being one and he makes an equivalent one. But the bottom line is the Jews and the Muslims are in very, very strong agreement that God is one, and that anybody who says something different than that is missing the point. In Islam, being a polytheist is the worst thing you can be. So they'd almost rather you be an atheist than be a polytheist. Being a polytheist or attributing things to God that are not godly is called shirk, and it's like instant death. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that, maybe. But in Israel, there was no putting anybody, you know, Baal does not get to be put on the same level as God. Asherah does not get to be put on the same level as God. They are not the same. So Christianity seems to almost be like, we're a little more liberal about that. We can have three. That's the way you might think of it, but that's not what Orthodox Christianity says. Orthodox Christianity is just, ought to be, or when it is being properly Orthodox, is just as insistent that God is one. And then the equivocation a little bit will be, that seems like an equivocation, is, but somehow there are three persons to this God. So that's what we're going to explain here, is how can you be as stringently a monotheist as a Muslim or a Jew, and which you ought to be if you're a Christian, and yet still affirm that God has three persons. That's the mystery that we want to answer here. And I use the word mystery there as in something that can be discovered, not the word mystery that means, well, we'll just leave it up there. When I went to the EPS annual meeting, ETS EPS meeting, to present this paper, the guy that stood up before me basically made a very eloquent, well-written, I mean, this guy's a published doctor and whatever, the Trinity is a mystery and it cannot possibly be solved. And then I get right up afterwards and give this one, and like, nope, this is exactly how you understand it. And I don't know if this is the proper way to say it, but I was pleased to see the dismay on his face. Because what he said at the end of it was, well, if this is true, then everything that I just said would be wrong. And I said, I genuinely and graciously, though, hope that that is the case. So is there a way to explain this? I truly believe the answer is yes. Yes, you can understand this. You don't have to punt. You don't have to say, forget logic. We're not going to think about that. There is an explanation to this. And so let's get to it. So first, is it the case that God is one? I'll read for you Isaiah 45. Verses 5a and then 18, and skipping between the two. God is saying, I am the Lord. In this case, when you see in your Bibles, Lord printed in all caps, that is usually means, I am, he's using his name, Yahweh, which means I am the I am. And there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. So this isn't a, when you look at the word for the Lord, when you see the Lord kind of smaller, case in the Old Testament, the word there is Elohim. Now, Elohim is a plural word. And so in this, you actually see this in ancient Greek writings too. You'll see in Platonic and Aristotelian writings and stuff, them talking about the gods. But then sometimes you'll see it translated in English as God. And it has to do with whether there appear to be ancient Greeks who actually believed that God was one, and that the panoply of gods was something that they kind of put up with, but they didn't believe. Others seem to believe in the whole panoply, so kind of it's hard to tell with the Greeks, but with the Jews, it was not hard to tell. They were very clear about what they said, but Elohim, being a plural word, sounds like the gods. And you will frequently see a heavenly court kind of scene in the Old Testament. So you might think of the time there was kind of a spirit. Let's think of Job. God is in heaven, and Satan presents himself with the angels. So there's like this court in heaven. The angels are there. They've got some morning ritual because Satan's showing up for like the morning meeting, practically, or the morning service, or whatever it is. And God's like, hey, I see you're here. Where have you come from? And Satan says, I've been walking around on the earth. And God says, have you seen my servant Job? So this conversation happens kind of in heaven, and it's this heavenly court. You also hear God say stuff like, let us do these things, right? So, or let us make man in our image. Yeah, that's a great example of plural. Now, some people will say, well, this is the royal we type of idea, but that's that doesn't seem to fit all of the occasions that God says this. So there does seem to be a heavenly court. Now, the question is it some sort of papal or cardinal court where God, Elohim, is just the first among equals? You know, they're all equally ranked gods, but for some reason this guy's been elected or appointed the one who's in charge. That's also not the Jewish concept. So whilst the term Elohim does mean plural, nobody in the Jewish religion is confused about how many gods there are. So I think where it starts to get confusing is Jesus at one point, in response to a question that gets raised, says, do the scriptures not say you are gods? And he's talking to the Israelites. He's not talking to some divine being. He's talking to the Israelites. You are gods. Or Paul says a couple of these things we'll look at later. But the idea of divinity and what gods are, what the powers of beings are, or I should have brought it up. Maybe I'll find it the next time. Thanks. Genesis 1:26, for those that were looking it up, says Peter. Do you remember in the movie Thor, where you know, he says, you know, here we are gods, and eventually the, what's Thor's father's name? How have I blanked on this? Odin. Odin says, we are not gods. And you're like, well, I thought we said earlier we were gods. And what he's really saying is we are just powerful beings that are more powerful and longer lived than these other things like humans or whatever else. Whilst there may be tiers of beings, I mean, even on Earth, we kind of do. We have humans and we have dogs and we have turtles. Some of them live longer than others. Some of them clearly have more power than others. Is that also true of other beings, angels and whatnot? It could be. And so maybe you want to, if you saw an angel who can appear and disappear, who can light stuff on fire with his will, who, you know, whatever the kind of stories you see in the Old Testament, and you say to yourself, is this a god? If by God what you mean is somebody more powerful than me that can do stuff that for all I know looks like magic, then okay, sure, then that's a god. Is that the top level like God when we talk about God as Elohim or the Lord or the Almighty God or HaTheos, the God, or Allah, the God?
Clearly in Revelation, John is, you know, read by an angel and he's like, stop that.
Yeah, don't worship me. I'm just another creature like you are. Yes, exactly right. So whilst you will see, especially throughout the Old Testament and some of the New Testament, references to gods, all of these are references to sub-creatures that are not on par with the one that we call Elohim, or the scriptures call Elohim, or HaTheos in Greek. So now the question for the Christian, if you kind of buy that, and we'll see some more, I'll read you a couple others like that. In fact, there is, for those who encounter people from the Mormon Church or the Latter-day Saints, somebody look up John 10:30 for me, if you could, and read that whenever you get it. There's a, I'll read one in a second that I think is like your best anti-Mormon. If anybody's looking for a single anti-Mormon concept of God verse, I'll show it to you in 1 second here. But let me finish Isaiah 45. I am the Lord, there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I'm skipping ahead to 18. For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, in parenthesis, he is God, who formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it a chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. So this is God saying, not I'm the God of Israel, and you know I'm going to help you defeat the God of the Canaanites. It's, no, I'm the God of Israel. I also happen to be the God of everything. The Canaanites just don't recognize it. That would be more accurate a way of trying to interpret what I just said. So let me bring up Isaiah 43.
John,
I think this
verses,
is, yeah, go ahead, please.
The Father and I are one. This is right after he's saying,
yes, right. Okay, well, so again, Peter is impatient with me and moves us forward to the part that we're going to talk about in a little bit here. So Isaiah 43:10 says, you are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. And I am he is also a short version of what God says, I am as his name. Before me, no God was formed, nor will there be one after me. I, even I, am the Lord. Now, the Mormon concept of God is, as man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. That's kind of a short version of Mormonism. It's something they say in their rituals, some of their rituals. I understand. I haven't been part of their rituals, so I can't tell you from firsthand experience. But that the concept is there's almost an infinite regress of gods, of which Elohim is but one. And Jesus and Satan are actually kind of brothers, both sons of Elohim, that type of thing. So it's if you're going to say I'm a Mormon and I believe that the Bible is true as well, and the Book of Mormon just gives you more data, the problem that you run into is before me no God was formed, nor will there be one after me. So this is very much anti to that Mormon concept of God, and it's anti to a lot of concepts of God, not just Mormonism. But it basically puts God in the category of the only one who ever was and the only one who ever will be, and of course, at present, the only one who is. So this is a very staunchly monotheistic view. In fact, if you, my brother, whom I love more than anything, other than my own wife and kids, we kind of go back and forth a little bit, and he went through some time, and maybe is still some in it. He's not here, so I feel free to pick on him. Where he said sarcasm, he didn't like sarcasm because he felt that it was sending the wrong message to people. And I was like, well, God's sarcastic, and Paul's sarcastic, and so you can't say sarcasm is inherently bad. Maybe the way we use it is bad, but read Isaiah and see how sarcastic God is about these other idols. I mean, Isaiah practically seems like, as he's writing, falls on the floor laughing at, like, he's like, so this guy, right? He throws this thing into the fire. He heats it up himself. He's the one that carves this thing out. He pours it in. He fixes these chains around it. And right when he's done, you know what this, they didn't say idiot in there, but you know what this knucklehead does? He falls down and worships it. He just made it and he's worshiping it. And you get this feeling when you read it, if you're not reading it like a, you know, like a Puritan might, of like, it's hilarious, is what Isaiah thinks, or how Isaiah is conceiving of this. So, there, at any rate, there's some key sarcastic moments in the Bible. Maybe I'll point those out sometime.
Have you seen the apologist, Jeff Durbin?
Yes.
He does a great job of, I mean, he's a little rough sometimes, how he handles stuff, but he does a really good job of witnessing to Mormons, and he quotes Isaiah, I think there's Romans 3-5. I mean, there's a bunch of scriptures that directly just don't fall in line with Mormon doctrine.
Yeah, so by all means, whatever, if you know anything like that, post it up and we'll have a look. Yes, sir.
So I'm trying to reconcile a couple of things that you have said.
Yes, sir.
In the Old Testament, there are references to gods.
Yes.
Lesser gods.
We like to say lowercase
gods.
Yeah.
Right. But, and we take that, the Christian position is that that is literal, that those are literal beings. That not that that is a, because there's references to false gods too.
Yes, right.
But that those are two different things.
Right. Not all gods in the Old Testament are false gods.
Right. Yes,
exactly right.
Okay.
So the question here is, what does it mean to be of the nature of being a god? Or what is it that divine nature entails? So one way to conceive of it is to say... So the guy I'm thinking of, there's a guy who is probably not what we would call orthodox in most of Christianity, because he is he's an open theist, which I don't think is actually should be a terribly controversial position. But he's a monotheist who basically says the concept of aseity only applies to the Father. So he's a Trinitarian. He'll call himself a Trinitarian monotheist, where what he means by that is that there's a rank structure here of the Father is God, and that the Son and Spirit, and then we're going to put in here little g gods, and maybe we can say angels, because it does seem to be the same. The Bible does seem to say that men are a little lower, you know, a little lower than the angels is what Jesus was supposed to be.
He's not an Arian? I mean, seems like you're just drawing a different model of
Arianism. Well, he thinks that the word Arianism is applied to mean absolutely anything that doesn't agree with whatever your concept of the Trinity is. And so he wants people to break out Arianism. So I think some people would... Yeah, right, yeah. And the reason I put men and gods in here is because there are parts of Scripture that seem to refer to men as gods, in that, you know, he says to them, you are gods, type of thing. So it's this tiered off thing, but he would say that this right here is the cutoff for the truly divine nature, but that this is the cutoff right here for what God as the highest form, the ha theos, the I am, with respect to being a being that possesses aseity, necessary existence, all that kind of stuff, that only one person, the Father, is that. And that the Son and Spirit, while divine, are not divine in the same way that the Father is. So
using intertrinitarian submission, right?
Yes. Yeah, there is. Some of it has to do with this. So you'll see why this is confusing rapidly, because there's going to be a lot of debate about what constitutes all this. Now, it is the case that when you look in the Bible, you do seem to see that the Son and the Father seem to be in this relationship where the Father has a primacy. Even the name Father seems to have some sort of primacy over the name Son. And the Spirit often gets ignored in a lot of these discussions, it seems to me as well, but that we have to come up with some model that makes the bottom line is, in order to understand it properly, if Christianity is true, it must be the case that all three of these beings, that all three of these are not beings, that this is one being that somehow has three persons to it. And that's where we're trying to get. If you end up with a concept that says there are these three distinct beings, that's tritheism. Three gods. Now, maybe one god is the original and the other two are created gods or gods that are dependent on it, but that would still be tritheism. And a Christianity that is tritheistic is not Christianity. You can't be tritheistic and a Christian, because that's not, you can't be tritheism and an Orthodox Christian, because that doesn't meet with what's been defined as orthodoxy. I saw a hand. Yes, sir.
I may be a little off based on my research, but some of the tribal polytheistic religions, it kind of seems like those mid-range gods are almost proxies or intermediates to an indifferent one god.
So yes.
Even those polytheistic religions, even though they're praying to the rain god or whatever they want to pray to, it's because that's the only thing they have contact with.
Right. It's like almost like the rain god is he's delegated authority. God let, hey, you're in charge of the rain. They can talk to you about that. You know, you're in charge of crop fertility. They can talk to you about that. Yeah, right. But that is not you're right. That is a common concept out there among just kind of tribal religions, but that is not is the same as the Christian concept. You're right as well. Did I see another hand? Dennis, yes, sir.
Atheists take the position that there's no single religion or God out there that has a bigger claim to being the religion than any other. I mean, to us, everybody in here is an atheist. We just go one God further, as Christopher used to say.
Yeah, he does say that. I will admit, Christopher Hitchens says certainly can turn a phrase, right? Or could turn a phrase. Right. The problem with that is there's no definition of atheism that lets you believe in a God at all that's still worthy of the name.
But what about one of our favorite cartoons shows a rabbi, a Muslim imam, or whoever their preachers are, going up their steps to the Golden Gates, and they see... what's the other one?
Peter.
Catholic priest or somebody coming down, and he's got this long face on him, and he says, well, "What's the matter?" He says, "The guy at the gate says the Mormons were right." Which is our way of saying, you know, any one of them could be right, and no one religion has any better claim than another.
And that is the point, that any one of them could be right. And so we have to do the only thing that we can do in order to determine which of those is true, which is study, debate, look at logic, look at evidence from natural theology, et cetera. So that is the purpose of this class, is not to take Christianity at its face and just say, you know, I wandered into a church one day and somebody said something and it sounded really good to me, and so I committed my life to it. And do I really know what it's about? That wasn't my experience. My experience was something that was I experienced God as a real thing, as real as toast and juice to me, and maybe better, more religiously, bread and wine. But it is it is the case that we ought not just stop there and say, well, now I have met this God, I don't want to know anything about him. We want to understand it. And we want to understand if the Christian concept is in fact correct. Because if it's not, there's no point in wandering around believing something that's not true.
This is something. I was talking to somebody at a funeral yesterday, and that unfortunately was a friend of mine, and he took his own life, and he was very staunchly atheist. And he said that one of the guys that I was at the funeral with was a friend of ours in that group. He said, you know, I wish that he had been more religious. Yeah, maybe that would have helped him. And I think he was kind of trying to acquiesce to some of my thought, but I just thought, like, why? That doesn't help. You have to know the truth, right? I mean, just picking one and trying to use it as some kind of balm or salt to your depression or whatever is not effective. And that's not the point of this, and it's not the point of this class at all. Like, you have to know what's true and then go after that, you know. This isn't an opiate, you know. I mean,
well, although I'd love to believe you,
yeah.
Ignorance is bliss. And so... I totally disagree with you. There are a small segment of people who decide they need to know the truth, but most people are not. And they just need to get through their lives, and they just need a framework in which to get through. So I'd love to believe you that everybody wants to be philosopher and seek wisdom, but that's just not true.
I would say that's the purpose of this class. They're just
and you see that not everybody's here. So
but Eric and Lang are fixing that. So ultimately I'm just kidding.
I agree with you. And this is kind of off topic. Yes. I agree. Most people are just trying to get through life. But
can we go back to the polytheism and the multiple gods thing? So
I'll put an asterisk by the everybody. There are people who just want to get through life thing. Because I want to address that later. But yes, sir, go ahead.
Because what you're bringing up is this abstract concept in a lot of polytheism, and that there's this, you know, abstract god that's more central, or you know. And because in a lot of these polytheisms, they're actually multiple religions that have been combined together over time. And the priests have had to try to, you know, the religious people have tried to have to, you know, figure out how to align them. But something that is also, that you brought up that is in Christianity, is that there's also people kind of trying to do the other thing, which is basically derive this lesser gods by saying that, which is what your pyramid is, oh, well, this is the original god, and then he split, which is the concept of the multiple personalities. And that has a lot of problems and, you know, consistency and things like that.
Yeah, we'll talk about those problems as we go along. That's true. All right, let me just run through a few verses here because the point is to point out that Christianity here is as having to affirm, if you're going to say you're a Christian, you have to affirm monotheism. So Old Testament stuff, and Peter jumping in on something, I think that was mentioned as well, that Christianity as a coping mechanism doesn't relate to its truth value. He says no relation, maybe. I think things that are true can help us cope more than things that are false, but it is the case that there are false beliefs that people just hold on to because it gets you through the night, so to speak. Okay, so let's just look at some of these real quickly. Mark 12:29, when Jesus is asked what's the greatest commandment, Jesus, who if Christians got it right, is the second person of the Trinity, of God, says, the first is, Hear, O Israel. He gives the Shema, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Fundamental commandment and confession of Israel. When they say, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus doesn't pick anything other than this. That should be important to the Christian. Romans 3:29-30a, is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also, since God is one. So again, Paul doesn't conceive the Jewish God to be just one of many, as we've talked about. 1 Corinthians 8:4, Paul says, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, and that there is no God but one. So kind of to Schuyler's point of there are some gods that are not real gods and some that seem to be are, that this one is saying idols are those that we define as don't have any real existence.
Can we stop there for a second?
Yes, sir.
We talked about, I guess it was in the service 2 weeks ago, they showed a video on the Shema, and it was talking about how the word heart was the epicenter of humanity in Jewish thought. I just think that we get down to a little lowercase God, and we talk about semantics, and we have to kind of look at that as what the original meaning was, the intent of the writers. Because I'm with you. I'm like, oh, why would you just say God? Why wouldn't you just say like extremely powerful being? And I think it gets down to like when you look at the Jewish conception of the heart, that was the decision making. They had no concept of brain. That was the where all the desires and urges came from. This is where. To think of little g God and go, well, we're stuck defining it the way that we define it right now might not be the best way to think of it.
I think that's true. 1 Timothy 2:5, for there is one God and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. Now, somebody mentioned kind of the mediator side of, hey, the rain gods might be like this. So it is important to find out, hey, is Paul saying that something like this tiered approach is true? Now, by the way, I'm drawing this. This is not. I don't think this is the Orthodox view. This belongs to this one person. So this is maybe I would say not Orthodox. But that is, we're trying to find out is that the model that Scripture seems to show? Because that's important. If Scripture does describe it principally that way, then we want to say, might that be the case? And we should consider that as true unless we figure out a way that we just didn't understand it correctly. And in James 2:19, God says, and this is interesting, you believe that God, this one has a few applications, you believe that God is one, you do well, which is like great. Even the demons believe and shudder. So even demonic forces here, he says, are monotheists. So it's not, James is saying it's not enough to simply be a monotheist. So maybe for the Muslim that believes that Injil is preserved and true, it's not enough to say there is no God but God. You also have to say, and I'm going to do something about that, and Christianity is a lot about what one has to do or believe about that. But it's not enough to believe that God is one. And by the way, what's the obvious most obvious major difference between the demons and Christians as an example? Both of them believe God is one, but say again, sir.
People want to follow after God.
Yeah, one group says we're in rebellion against God, and the other one hopefully says we are making God our Lord.
Also, one knows there's a God, and the other one has faith that there's a God.
Well, I will also asterisk that one, and we can talk about that one later. Because to me, you don't have faith that God exists. Because faith is an incomplete statement. I have faith. You have to say, I have faith in something. So I have to say, I have faith in the belief that God exists. Well, belief is your own thing. That's not something that you can have faith in. What you do is you say, God exists, and he told me X. In the case of the Christian, what he told you was, I will forgive your sins, and I will raise you to life again, and you may live forever with me in love and harmony. That's the promise. Or what he told Abraham was, I will make of you a great nation. So Abraham's faith was the belief that God would do that, even though he was a terribly old man and his wife was old and all that kind of stuff. So yes, all that is true with that one, I think, caveat.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So does he believe he's better than everything and everybody?
Does God believe he's better than everybody?
Right, so like when he looks at other gods, he's saying, yeah, you're a god, but you're never going to be me. So that creates competition,
right? Yeah.
Which is why evil was created, right?
So if it was the case that there was God, the guy we'll call God, so to speak, the persons or being that we'll call God, and then let's say there was Satan, and let's say we will throw in Bob. I don't know who Bob is, but Bob is a third person. And if these guys would just kind of find themselves floating around in heaven, and then it's basically God just says, hey, you know what, I'm number one. And Satan says, are you number one? I want to be number one. If that's the way that it was, then I think you're right. Then God just basically is an uppity being who decided that he was going to be in charge. But that's not the concept of God that the Jew, the Muslim, or the Christian believes in. The way the Jew and the Muslim and the Christian believe is that God exists in a way that no other being does. And this was a few classes back, we talked about God as a necessary being, as the greatest possible being. So God, by the very concept of who he is, no matter what he creates, no matter what he can, basically, that God is the only self-existent, self-sufficient being. And so there was God, you could say it this way, and then anything else that happens, let's say Satan exists, and let's let Bob exist as well, that there was a state in which they did not exist, and only God exists, and then later they exist. Same thing with Bob. And so these are beings that owe their origin to God, that God was the creator of them. And so there, it is not that, that it's three people that found themselves in a classroom or on a field and said, who of us is stronger? It's one of them brings two of them into existence. Now, if a being brings you into existence, it would be a strange thing indeed to say, well, I'm a greater thing than you are, unless you're conceiving of it like how people build machines or something like that. We can conceive of a human being, a scientist, building an Iron Man kind of robot, and that robot, they program him like Jarvis, and Jarvis takes over, and you get, what's Jarvis when he became instantiated? What was the name of the Vision guy, the red dude in the Marvel universe? That this being is more powerful than the guys that created him. So that concept is not the concept in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The concept is that God sits here with all powers. So for him to, some people criticize a strain of Christianity, Reform Christianity, which is actually probably the predominant one in America, that says that one of God's principal goals is to glorify himself. And it sounds, some people say, well, it sounds like God is being just the ultimate narcissist. Is he just saying, you just need to pay attention to me? The reason I don't think that that Reformed theologians should be criticized on those grounds is this. If God, you know, Satan, and we'll put Bob and we'll put Michael and we'll
Scott,
put other...
Scott, add the Trinity to this, because that makes this different.
Oh, I just want, let's leave, if there's a Trinity, it's all in the God side.
Right, but the intention and the purpose of these beings being created is totally different than just, I'm going to.
Yes, that's where I'm headed. So if God creates these things, and then on a, maybe a lower level, you get, you know, me and you and whoever else, you know, other human beings, and then maybe an even lower level over here is cow. whatever you want to put in the order, and this is kind of an ascending order of greatness or powerfulness or whatever. So are you better than a cow?
No.
Okay, so in the same way, why are you not better than a cow?
Because it's a living thing.
Okay, so anything that has life has value. Now, is the value to your life greater than the value to a cow's life?
No.
Are you a vegetarian?
Yes.
Bingo. All right, so on that statement, what you have said then is, now why do you give to the cow? Why does being a living being, well, plants are alive.
Right.
So is a cow greater than grass?
But that's different. Like,
okay, and the difference is important here.
Like,
so
plants and grass don't have the same.
They don't feel pain.
They don't
have some sort of conscious existence.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's say that it's the case that let's say it's the case that they don't feel pain or they're not conscious, sure. Like cows are conscious. Now our consciousness is clearly greater than a cow's consciousness. We do math and science and kill each other by the millions in wartime. Cows don't do that. Sarcasm, in case anybody was wondering. But what we say here is something about being a conscious being gives it value. And maybe we say equal value. So what you could say here is, let's say for a second that regard is true. That what you say is, you know what, if this is a conscious being, or let's say one that has free will, if you found out that cows and dogs have free will like human beings, you would say, then we should never kill a cow or a dog because they're just like us. But what if you found out that they were basically just high-speed robots? Would you still feel the same way? So imagine instead where they don't have free will, they don't have consciousness, they're just kind of programmed machines. Mm-hmm. Then maybe you would say, well, they don't have the same value in the same way that if you and I built a robot together that does all the things people do, but they don't have, it doesn't have consciousness like we do, powering it down wouldn't make us feel bad. It wouldn't be immoral to do so. Interesting, I mean, I'm going to jump way forward on this one, but it'll hit your point. We, the Christians and the Jews, do not have a God who said, I am, what he said was basically, I am more powerful than you are. I am more knowledgeable than you are. I am smarter than you are. All of which is true, right? That would be true. If God really is all-knowing, if he's the one who built this, built DNA, built the world, built the laws of nature, then clearly he knows more than we do because we don't know how any of that stuff really works. So he's smarter than us, he's obviously more powerful than us, but is he worth more than us? Now what God does, if the Christian is right, is God sends his own son, and if in the Trinity case, it's who is God as well, and the son comes down and tells us, I have not called you servants, but I have called you friends. And he said, and when someone says to Jesus, your mother and your brothers are outside asking to speak to you, what does Jesus reply to him? He who does the will of my Father in heaven is my mother and my brother. And he points to the disciples and says, these are my mother and my brothers. This is, now keep in mind what this is. If the Christian concept of God is right, God loves us and values us so much that he became a cow, so to speak, to live amongst the cows and even let himself be killed by the cows to show the cows how much he loved them. That's the kind of God the Christian has. And for that reason alone, I want to find out if Christianity is true, because if that's the case, that's my... That fulfills for me a lot of things that I would want. Now, by the same token, the Reform view of God says, I'm worthy of all worship and must be worshipped. That just may be a statement of fact, right? So if you're in a, we live in a very egalitarian society right now where we want to say everybody is equal. But everybody is equal, we mean in value. What we ought to mean is in value, not in capability, right? The Smiths have a daughter who is a MMA fighter, and I have to admit that even though she's a girl, I'm not 100% sure I'd like to climb in the ring with her. Like, she may have some skills and abilities that beat my own, and lest I be knocked out on the floor unconscious, I might have to admit of like, okay, we're of equal worth, but you probably could kick my butt. So let's say that that's the case. That doesn't mean I think she's worth more than I am. What I mean to say is she's better at this particular thing. Likewise, I could walk into MIT or Harvard, or I could walk into any local college here and say, here's a guy or gal who's smarter than I am. But just because they're smarter than I am, or they can do math faster than I can do it, or they can understand concepts that I can't understand, doesn't make them more valuable or worthy than I am. It just makes them more smarter than I am. So in that sense, God is, if he has one thing that is a worth that we can't possibly have, it's this necessary existence stuff. But I'll have to vector you to some former classes in order to go into that, because we don't have time to do that now. But I want to say that it is right for God to, if God walks in here and say, or let's pretend it's the case that I'm the smartest guy in the room and I'm the fastest runner in the room. Let's pretend that those are the two things. For me to get in here and say, hey, look, everybody in here is just as smart as I am, and every one of you can run just as fast as I can. Is that true or is that false? False. So I would be, it would be evil of me to say, you're just as smart as I am, you're just as fast as I am. It would be right of me to say, look, I'm smarter than you and I'm faster than you. And then the next good thing to say is, now, how can I use my smarts and my speed to help you where you're not as smart and you're not as fast? And that is, in fact, what God does for us. So I commend the study of Christianity to you on those grounds, if no others. Okay, how to be a cow and love the guy that came and became a cow for us. This is the first time I've used that analogy, so thank you for that.
Is that chart up there saying that God created Satan?
Yes.
And that's what you believe?
Yes. There's not a ton of scriptural data on there, but the kind of the Orthodox Christian belief is that Satan, the one we call Satan, was, or Lucifer, the angel of light, was an archangel and arguably the highest archangel. And because of his kind of penultimate status, at one point he said, I want to run this place. And God said, that's not right. And he got a third of the angels to follow him. And there was war in heaven, and they get cast down to the earth, and this is how this kind of stuff happens.
But God created it.
But God created it, yes. So that is definitely the Christian.
Even beyond this, the redemption part of it, because that can still leave you feeling like I was created as maybe an object of wrath. When you look at the triune God, the only possibility, we talked about this before, the only possibility is to be created out of love, to be an object of love, like to be... you know, when they say God is love in the scriptures, like literally beings created to get the best out of life, to get the best out of God. And this is so utterly, like I even struggled very much so with being like, God must be up there kind of going like, God, Kevin, you're all right. I wish you were a little bit further along. I wish you'd listen to me a little bit more. I'm like low-level disappointed in you. But to know that God created me and created everybody as an object of love, like the intent of you being born was so that God could show you the best possible existence now and on earth and then in heaven forever. You're like,
well, it's good that he mentions this now, because we're out of time, so I will wrap it up here. But this concept that he's talking about, God, who's one of his essential properties and the one to which he points, what?
I think that sounds so selfish, like on that, like I'm an object of love for God. Like, why would he want that? Like, I'm not an object.
Right. So I don't think object here is used in the philosophical term, not in the objectified term that we men make of women sex objects, or
sure,
of slaves objects for labor or something like that.
But it's like, it kind of sounds like I owe him something.
Aha. So interesting question there.
Why?
Do you owe your parents anything at all?
Yeah.
Why?
A lot of money.
Quick case in point. Why do you owe your parents something, let's say non-monetarily, just as a 4-year-old?
Because they're there for me, they raised me.
And they're the ones that kind of brought you into this world and taken principal responsibility. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, if God were to say, you kind of just owe me the same respect and loyalty that you owe your parents, you wouldn't have a problem with that.
No.
Okay. What is the greatest sentiment in the world? What's the greatest feeling? What's the greatest state of relationship in the world?
Happiness.
What makes you most happy? What makes you happier? I could offer you two things. Here, not here, I was about to point it at Eric. Eric's taken. In this empty chair behind the projector sits a man, the ultimate man, like the greatest man you could ever want. And he would be a loving and wonderful husband to you. And by the way, he wants to marry you. And over here is $1 million. Which one do you want? And by the way, this guy's poor.
So,
he can still feed you. He can still feed you, but he loves you, and he will always love you. And this is $1 million. Which one do you want? Which makes you happier?
But you don't live out of love, like you.
I'm just saying, which one would make you more happy?
So I'm poor, but in love.
Yes.
Or $1 million.
And alone.
$1 million.
You'd rather have $1 million than be alone? Okay, all right. Very good. I'll take this from another. I hope nobody minds if we keep going for a little bit here, because it's now become very interesting. On what do you spend most of your money, if I may ask?
My puppies, food.
Puppies and food. Okay, why puppies? It's an odd choice to spend money on.
Because I love them.
Ah, so love does make you happy.
Right, but I have.
Do your puppies?
If I have the money to take care of them, I mean, I wouldn't be able to have them.
I didn't mean he had no money. I just meant, let's say that this guy has enough money that you can buy puppies as well.
Oh, yeah.
Then to him? Okay.
Yeah, we're done doing.
All right. Very good. Well, I think most people would agree that in the all the fairy tales, they lived happily ever after. That's one of the reasons is that you're happy is that you have this love relationship. So nobody, the story never ends. And he went on alone, but he was very rich, and he lived happily ever after. Nobody says that. It's the guy ends up with the girl ends up with the guy. Love is the ultimate thing. So if what God says is, I recognize about the world because of, I won't put the reason in for you now, that love is the greatest thing ever. It's not a selfish thing to want people to be objects of his love if love is bidirectional. They also love him back. What he's saying is, I want the free agents to have what is essentially the best thing about me. A great thing about a guy is a guy is a great guy if what he says to you as a girlfriend, fiance, and wife, I want you to have the best of me. And whatever is best about me, I dedicate to in service to making you happy. Interestingly, this all-powerful, self-existent God did exactly that for us. So that's why I would say the Christian concept of God is the God, in my mind, who's not only the most loving, but also is the most worthy of worship, because who's the most worthy husband? The one who says, I'm going to go head down my own career and do all the stuff for myself, and come along if you'd like. Or alternately, I'm going to vector all these forces towards making you as happy as I can. And in fact, I'm going to create a home that makes you maximally happy, a family that makes you maximally happy, you know, all the accoutrements that I give you are to make you happy. Puppies. That's the puppies. So that's the concept of God that we're pursuing here. Dennis, you have the last word, and then we'll go to the next time.
One thing that's always bothered me about Christianity is that every reference to anything divine is, they're always males. Gabriel, Michael, all the angels. Were there any female angels?
Well, Jesus says angels are neither married nor given in marriage. So even though the pronouns we use are male in there, they are not sexual beings like we are, so they don't have...
I didn't say that, but it's all the references are either him, he... Today, well,
as a nominal Jew, you will know where the source of this is. Is this is in a milieu that says woman was a not second in value, but a second in order creation, where man was created first and then and woman was created, and they were, you know, they have this interplay amongst each other. So it's only in that paradigm that the way that we refer in gender to these beings occurs. But let's address that one a little bit longer. I'll give you a longer answer later on that one. Okay, the purpose of today's class was to for everybody to understand, one, we're getting into the Trinity, but two, the concept that we're after here says, in whatever discussion happens on the Trinity, it must conclude with God is one, not in just some name, but in reality. How is God one being, but three persons? So, and we showed the scriptures that say God is one very clearly. Next time we're going to get into how can this possibly be three and be logically self-consistent. All right, thank you for your time and attention, and we'll see you next time. And have fun with the